Juan Cole is a public intellectual, prominent blogger and essayist, and the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, with a focus on the modern Middle East and South Asia. Cole obtained his BA in History and Literature of Religions from Northwestern in 1975. For two quarters in his senior year, he conducted a research project in Beirut, returning to the city afterwards as a graduate student, but the Lebanese Civil War interrupted that, preventing him from continuing his studies there. He then pursued a master's degree at the American University in Cairo in Islamic and Middle Eastern Studies, graduating in 1978, after which he returned to Beirut for another year, where he worked as a translator for a newspaper. In 1984, he received his doctorate in history from the University of California and was then appointed assistant professor of history at the University of Michigan, where he became a full professor in 1995. His blog, Informed Comment, has been one of the most sought-after sources for What Else? Informed Comment on Middle Eastern Issues. It's my pleasure to welcome Professor Juan Cole to Takes on the World.
Thanks so much.
Happy to have you with us. Since that Tunisian street peddler, Mohamed Bouazizi, burned himself to death in December 2010, igniting the so-called Arab Spring, the Middle East has become like a bloody board game with Egypt as latest battlefield, but at no time, at least in my memory, has any event or series of events caused such differences of opinion across the political spectrum as what we have seen happen in Egypt over the past week. One of the most unusual responses, and what intrigued me, was the title of your article on the eve of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi's ouster, comparing him and the Muslim Brotherhood with Michelle Bachmann and the Tea Party. Well, let's start with that.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood is a phenomenon of the religious right in Egypt. It supports religious values in government, and it also is very tied to a business class, because the Muslim Brotherhood in the old days was discriminated against by the secular-leaning authoritarian government of Hosni Mubarak, and it had a huge public sector. About 50% of the economy is in government hands in Egypt, and they just didn't let people who were known Muslim brothers flourish inside the government. So a lot of Muslim brothers started businesses and are shopkeepers or even executives of corporations. And so the Muslim Brotherhood has this configuration of being devoted to values in public life and inserting them in government, as well as being biased towards the private sector, towards business, and against the left and labor. That sounds to me, you know, generally ballpark, a similar configuration to that of the Tea Party in the United States.
Well, one of the things that occurred to me is that Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood did what might be called a bait and switch. The people who were protesting Mubarak were predominantly not the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood rode to power because they were well-organized on the backs of those people who were protesting in Tahrir Square, and ironically, they rode out on the backs of the same protesters, even more protesters. The question is the military's role in this, which was clearly a coup, and yet it was a rare situation where a coup was backed by millions of people. Maybe you comment on that.
Well, you're absolutely right that the young people who made the revolution in January and February of 2011 were, frankly, not necessarily very ideological. They just wanted that government gone. It was an oppressive government, had been there for a very long time, and they felt blocked. They felt blocked politically. They felt blocked economically. A lot of it was a jobs protest because there's very high unemployment among youth, especially educated youth. But then once they had overthrown the dictator, they got a military coup, which was not what they were looking for. And they pressured it to move to elections, and then the elections threw up the two main candidates were Mubarak's last vice president, a man of the old regime, and the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, who also had served in the Mubarak parliament, and you know, the Muslim Brothers were kind of in an adversarial position with the government, but they were also junior partners in the old regime. So the country had a choice, really, between two very unsatisfactory alternatives, and it was the Muslim Brother candidate because he was more oppositional to the old order, who squeaked out a victory, not by very much. But that wasn't, you know, at all the kind of thing that the young people were looking for. They weren't looking for a Muslim Brotherhood government. And Mohamed Morsi, the president, acted in very arrogant and high-handed ways. He started using many of the techniques that Mubarak had. It was a presidential system. A lot of power is concentrated in the presidency. At one point, he declared himself above the law. He rushed through a constitution that wasn't consensual. He tried to pack the upper house of parliament with his guys. He just behaved in ways that were completely unacceptable to the revolutionary youth who had wanted to move towards more democracy. And then he was prosecuting people for criticizing him and ridiculing him, including the Egyptian equivalent of John Stewart. So they got up this movement. They put 3-4 million people in the streets a week and a half ago, demanding early elections. It was basically a recall, like you have in California, of the governor. They wanted Morsi to contest elections again. They were convinced he couldn't win them again. He had a 4-year term, but they wanted to cut it short. This unrest again provoked a military coup, which the youth, I think, are a little bit unsettled with, but they're seeing if they can make it work.
Well, it's one of the not surprising phenomenon is the number of pundits outside who believe that the United States was somehow behind this coup, while it's quite likely that the United States may have been informed in advance. I don't see personally how the United States at this point in time, with Middle East policy crumbling in almost every arena, needs another headache in Egypt. How do you see that?
Well, in Egypt, the story is quite the opposite, at least among the activist youth. They think that the Obama administration supported the Muslim Brotherhood. I think the U.S. is going to get it from both sides. The Brotherhood is angry at it, and the youth are angry at it, because it's a status quo power. And so obviously, once there was an election and Morsi was elected, it was a free and fair election. He had the legitimacy of elective office, and the U.S. Decided to deal with him as president of Egypt. The things that have leaked in the press about the U.S. role is suggest that Ambassador Patterson and the Obama administration tried to impress upon General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi not to make a coup. In fact, Patterson, the ambassador, came out and said that the rebellion movement, the youth movement, should cancel its plans for massive demonstrations on June 30th. So quite the opposite. It appears that there's some evidence that the U.S. wanted to see if they couldn't make the status quo work, and the youth, the left liberal youth, are furious with Washington and with Obama over this stance.
Well, there's also a great deal is made of the fact that the United States provides $1.3 billion of weapons to Egypt every year, as if the army, which controls a great amount of the economy of Egypt, is going to make its policy on the basis of receiving more F-16 jets. It would seem, for me, and I get your take on this, is the U.S. is more in need of Egypt than Egypt is of the United States at this point.
Well, the United States certainly would like to keep Egypt in its orbit. The Suez Canal goes through Egypt. It carries about 10% of world trade annually, and so it's a very important artery for the United States and its allies. And then Egypt has a peace treaty with Israel. The United States is very interested in Israeli security. So there are all kinds of reasons. And then Egypt has been, at least in the past, an ally in the struggle with Iran. So there are many reasons for which the United States would like to keep Egypt stable and keep it pro-American and keep its government pro-American. The Congress does give Egypt $1.3 billion a year. About half of it is civilian aid and half of it is military. But it's not. The thing to remember about this kind of aid is that it's really aid to American corporations.
Exactly.
The Congress puts riders on it that the Egyptians have to purchase everything they buy with this money from U.S. corporations. So the money is going right back to Lockheed Martin and Boeing and so forth. Actually, the Egyptian military seems a little diffident about this aid because it comes with very strong political strings. But they've just been kind of piling up these helicopter gunships and things, which they don't have a use for. The Egyptian military is not at war with anybody and has no prospect of being at war with anybody. And so it's a little unclear what good it does them to be made to buy this military equipment every year from American arms corporations.
Well, you might extend that to the Saudis, who are the largest purchaser of U.S. Fighter jets, and I don't even think they have enough pilots to fly them.
No, nor do they have enough mechanics to keep them operating. Even in the United States, F-16s stay on the ground about 50% of the time for repairs. The prospect of the Saudis being able to work a sophisticated system like that anytime soon is low.
Well, we're talking about is literally a subsidy for American arm manufacturers, Lockheed Martin, and so on.
Yes, and also, you know, it's a kind of a ritual display, so the Saudis can, who are a small country, relatively speaking, can go to Iraq and Iran and neighbors that might be belligerent and say, look, we've got all this shiny weaponry, you'd better be afraid of us.
And now Egypt is applying for a $4.8 billion IMF loan. At the same time, the Saudis have announced that they're offering financial support. It seems like on a different level, Egypt is on this board game, not to the extent that Syria is, but we have these outside players trying to gain influence on a board in which the lives of the human beings of Egypt or Syria or Jordan to come, who knows, are mere pawns in the game, as the Bob Dylan song goes.
That's right. There's a very strong regional diplomacy about what has happened in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood government was popular with Turkey. It was colleagues with the Ennahda or Renaissance Party government in Tunisia, also religious right. And it was reaching out to Iran. It was trying to establish an embassy in Tehran and have flights to Iran from Egypt for the first time since 1979. So on the other hand, the Saudis, although they also are a government of the religious right, you know, have a different strain of religious right and have long been afraid of the Muslim Brotherhood as a revolutionary organization that might overthrow the Saudi king. And they weren't happy either with the Muslim Brotherhood coming to power in Egypt, nor with the Brotherhood's opening towards Iran. And so the Saudis seem to be just pleased as punch that the Egyptian military is back in the saddle. And they've offered, I think, $4 billion in aid. And the United Arab Emirates has similar concerns and also is offering money on that scale. It's not enough. Egypt had $32 billion in foreign currency reserves, which was how its currency system was stable and worked. They could defend the Egyptian pound with those currency reserves from tourism and sales of commodities. But because of the revolution, because of the fall off in tourism, because of poor economic management, including on Morsi's part, the reserves have fallen to more like $15 billion, and it's not enough. So the Egyptian pound is slipping, and since Egypt imports a lot of its food, its energy, the inflation for ordinary people is 20-30%. A lot of Egyptians, about 40%, live on $2 a day, and so it's tough economic times. And these kinds of sums that are being offered by the IMF, the Saudis, and the UAE will help, but they're not nearly enough to overcome this structural problem.
Now, excuse me. Now, on Monday morning, there was a protest at the National Guard headquarters by or started early in the morning of prayers in front of the Egyptian Guard offices, which ended up in a massacre in which at least 51 Egyptian members of the Muslim Brotherhood were killed. And there's a lot of different stories going on about how that happened. Was it provoked? Who was at fault? But at the end of the day, we had 51 dead members of the Muslim Brotherhood, several hundred injured, and the call by the Muslim Brotherhood for an uprising against the government, against the army. How is that going to play out, do you think? Are we going to see anything like what's happened in Syria? Of course, the Syria required outside arms coming in. Do you see that likely in a country like Egypt?
Well, Egypt is extremely polarized at the moment. The Muslim Brotherhood, which, however, is only one strain in Egypt of the religious right, is, of course, diehard opposed to this revolution and coup against it, has, since really last Friday, has pledged to wage a campaign to bring Morsi back, insist that he's the legitimate president. Morsi was rumored to be held in the Republican Guards barracks, which was why the Muslim Brotherhood was camping out outside of it. It was a very volatile situation. We don't know exactly what happened, whether the army tried to disperse them and did so very brutally, or whether the Brotherhood, as some reports suggest, elements of it made a move to on the barracks in order to try to free Morsi, and then the troops fired back. But whatever happened, of course, it was a great tragedy and horrified the Egyptian public, galvanized the Muslim Brotherhood in its campaign of opposition to what has happened. In the long term, whether this polarization can be overcome is not clear. The Brotherhood could turn to violence. It hasn't, for the most part, been a violent organization since it made a pact in the 1970s with Anwar al-Sadat that it would work peacefully and would be allowed to operate as a result. If it turned to violence, then the military would certainly try to repress it. It could be, you know, a civil war. It could be like Algeria in the 1990s. But if it ultimately decided to try to come back through participating in parliamentary elections, which have been called for late fall or early winter, then, you know, it could find maybe a way to save face. But it's a really tough, polarizing situation, and it's not clear whether Egypt can return to stability anytime soon.
Well, they have a new appointed president, a temporary president, and they have a transition plan that is supposed to produce these elections. Mohamed Elbaradei is now the vice president. He seems to be a controversial character, not that well known inside Egypt, former head of the International Atomic Energy Commission. What do you think of the prospect of these plans as being laid out now in the media of going to fruition?
Well, I think that it is likely that there will be a transition to new elections. And, you know, frankly, elections aren't that hard to hold. In Egypt, they're overseen by the judiciary, and the president is now also the Chief Justice of the Supreme Constitutional Court. So he'll have the cooperation of the Egyptian judiciary in overseeing those elections. The real question is whether the Brotherhood will boycott them and make them meaningless, since the Brotherhood won 45% of the votes in the last parliamentary election, and since they won the presidency in June of 2012. If they boycott and they refuse to be associated with this process, then it's going to be a very skewed resulting government and not fully representative. The other group on the religious right, the Salafis, who are hardline and more like the Saudi form of Islam, are so far on board with what has happened and seem likely to participate in the elections. And so they may pick up a lot of the Brotherhood vote, in which case the Brotherhood could marginalize itself and the liberals and the hardline fundamentalists could have a voice in the new government in January.
How much does class and age and education play in this situation?
Well, age is very important because something like 45% of the Arab world now is 30 years or younger. There's this huge youth bulge and it is the basis on which these youth movements of a political sort have been being mounted beginning in, well, before 2011, but which have shaken the region. So this is a youth movement, and the rebellion movement, or Tamarrad, which put 3 or 4 million people in the streets and overthrew Mohamed Morsi, is an example of youth power. They network on Facebook, and they have databases of potential members. They walk neighborhoods. They're a little bit like the Obama campaign in this regard, but not attached to a particular political party, with more general, vaguer goals of trying to move Egypt to something more like a parliamentary democracy with rights. Of freedom of speech and association and so forth. And in fact, they slapped down the new president when he issued a constitutional decree which didn't seem to be expansive enough with regard to rights. Just yesterday, they denounced it as inadequate. So the youth are a very important part of this story, both women and men. And the women have a big voice on the internet. They don't have so much of a voice, you know, in meet space in public squares. But they do come out. Probably about a fifth to a fourth of the crowds are women. But on the internet, often their YouTube videos or their interventions are galvanizing, and they have thrown up leaders. With regard to class, the youth have an alliance with the working class, with union workers, textile workers, and others, and they have had this alliance all through the last decade. And it's one of the things that they're protesting, is that the workers are very badly paid. They hadn't been allowed to form unions, to engage in legal strikes. There have been enormous numbers of strikes, about 2,000 in just in the past year. So there is a left labor tinge to this. You know, in a way, it reminds me of what the new left was trying to do in the late 60s in the United States, and having sort of middle class youth have an alliance with the working class, which fell apart because of the Vietnam War and for other reasons. But in Egypt so far, that alliance does exist. It's a youth slash worker alliance against the old establishment.
Does this Tamarud, this youth movement, have a real organizational framework yet?
It's what we call asymmetrical and acephalous. It's not an organization. It networks, and there's not a clear leadership. It's the darndest thing. I mean, I think, you know, it's a little bit like Occupy Wall Street, but on a huge, enormous scale. It's a phenomenon that we're all still trying to get our heads around, it's frustrating a little bit because you don't know where it's going or how exactly it works. My teacher, Sadeddin Ibrahim, a sociologist, flew back to Tahrir Square during the 2011 revolution. Being a sociologist, he kind of said to the youth, "Take me to your leader," and he told me, he said, they looked at him funny.
One of the things that is really important is to see this Egyptian struggle in the context of what is happening throughout the entire Middle East. We see the legacy of our war in Iraq is 2,000 dead in sectarian, what appears to be sectarian violence since April alone. That what appears to be, or is meant intent to be, Sunni versus Shia violence with the emergence of the Shia in Iraq after centuries of Sunnis in power, the power of Hezbollah in Lebanon, the power of the Shias, of course, in Iran, who seem to have gained some things from the Iraq War. How does Egypt's situation fit into that struggle?
Well, the struggle of a sectarian sort has been more characteristic of the Arab East. There's a strong division between the West and the East of the Arab world, the West being North Africa over to, say, Jordan, and where the vast majority of people are Arabic-speaking and Sunni in their sect, whereas in the east of the Arab world, you have a lot of religious diversity. You have very large Christian populations. You have Shiites. You have Sunnis. You have lots of sectarian groups which are in between or different from those. So as these governments have fallen, the Saddam Hussein government, which fell under U.S. Invasion, been challenged, as in Bahrain or Syria, the questions of power have thrown up also sectarian rivalry, and so you have a strong Sunni-Shiite split. I think, you know, it can be exaggerated because it's not as if the Shiites in Lebanon, who are mostly what are called Twelver Shiites, are supporting the Alawites in Syria, who are a kind of folk Shiism, very heterodox. You know, think among Christians, evangelicals and Mormons. So it's not as if they're supporting them primarily because they're fellow Shiites. Hezbollah in Lebanon is supporting the Syrian government because the Syrian government is allied with Iran, which also is Hezbollah's ally, and because it's a land bridge over which Iran can ship rockets and war material to Hezbollah in Lebanon. If Syria were to fall to forces inimical to Hezbollah in Iran, then they might cut off Hezbollah from its resupply, which would be a disaster for that organization. So, you know, I think the sectarian element is there. There are Sunnis who are fighting against the Ba'ath government in Syria because they see it as a Shiite-dominated government. But then there are a lot of Syrian Sunnis who are just fighting against it because it's dictatorial and had been happily members of the Ba'ath Party, 10 years ago.
And in the army, yes.
Yes, please.
And in the Syrian military.
The Syrian military, the officer corps is 80% Alawite. Mm. It is dominated by the Shiite sect. And it's one of the reasons that the government hasn't fallen. There's also, aside from the sectarian issue, which I think is more something that people can rework into political and social conflict, there's class again. A lot of the revolutionaries in Syria are small-town people or are recent immigrants to the cities from rural countryside who are jobless, the 2008 downturn, there's a long-term drought in Syria, all of these things caused a great deal of economic distress among the Syrian working class in the small cities of the center of the country, and they felt like the government just wasn't doing enough for them. It so happens that they are primarily Sunni, and the government is dominated by this Alawite Shiite group. But if they weren't from different sectarian groups, I think the revolt still would have happened, mainly on economic grounds.
It's interesting. You wrote about last month how Mohamed Morsi had called for a no-fly zone over Syria, had cut off his ties with the Syrian government, which, of course, created criticism of the fact that he maintained ties with Israel but had cut ties with Syria. And this was supposed to be like an overture to the Saudis and even to people in the Muslim Brotherhood who had not appreciated his overtures to Iran.
That's right. The Muslim Brotherhood has branches in a lot of Middle Eastern countries, but each branch is autonomous. There's not a central command structure, and each national Muslim Brotherhood group takes different stances, and often they're at odds with one another. Morsi was close to, or is close to, Hamas, the Palestinian version of the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza, which in turn had an alliance with Iran. Morsi kind of had an ambivalent stance on Syria because of that. And so the Muslim Brotherhood is among the major revolutionary forces in Syria and was absolutely furious with Morsi for not taking a strong stance on Syria. And finally, Morsi acquiesced in all of this pressure to call for a no-fly zone and the overthrow of the Syrian government. And among the first governments to congratulate General Assisi on his coup was, in fact, Syria. So they're very happy about this turn of events.
That's the Middle East. One thing I need to ask you is, at the beginning of the Iraq War, you were one of those who saw Saddam Hussein as a dictator, and whatever the cost were going to be, that it was going to be worthwhile to depose Saddam. And I know, reading other articles you've written since that, you may have changed your mind, but in retrospect, looking back now 10 years later, how do you see the situation in Iraq? And do you think the Iraqi people are better off today without Saddam than they were with Saddam? Or is that a kind of, if they were asked today, the average Iraqi on the street, do you think Saddam would be welcomed back by many just because he brought a sense of stability despite the dictatorship?
Well, I think that this whole issue of Iraq is extremely complex. I should clarify that I warned against the Iraq war and invasion. I told people, and I said at my blog, that the situation between Bush and Saddam reminded me of the scene in Star Wars where they're in the trash compactor and it starts to move, and Harrison Ford says, "I have a very bad feeling about this." I didn't think it was a wise thing to do. What I said later on, which people have misinterpreted, was, I knew that a lot of American troops were going to lose their lives. Over 4,000 did. And I my question, being from a service family myself, was, are these going to be wasted lives? And I took some comfort from the fact that Saddam was a dictator who was responsible for starting wars and for repressing people. Probably he polished off around 300,000 people, so that there would be some point to the sacrifice of lives. But I didn't support the war, and I didn't think it was a good idea. Obviously, it's been a huge disaster. I think none of us could have foreseen how badly the Bush administration would do. I mean, the previous interventions had been in places like Bosnia, which were smaller, and the U.S. hadn't really had any experience as an occupying power since World War II. And I had one friend who was over in Baghdad who said, you know, that these guys were enthusiastic amateurs. It has been a disaster, unmitigated disaster for Iraq. Senator McCain is just wrong about this. It wasn't nothing glorious about it, nothing successful about it. And no, I don't think anybody wants Saddam Hussein back, but I do think there are a lot of regrets about how things were handled. And as a result, Iraq is still a basket case.
We see also in Afghanistan where President Obama has now announced troops will be out in 2014. Is this Vietnam? Although the Taliban are not the North Vietnamese, is this going to be a situation where the United States pulls out, the Western troops pull out, and then it's back to where it was before 2001?
Well, you never know about these things. I mean, the United States, we just have this one analogy to Vietnam, but actually it's all decolonization. You know, both Iraq and Afghanistan are analogous to the British in Kenya and the French in Algeria and so forth. And any time you've had a foreign occupying force, you've had a kind of colonialism. When the metropolitan country goes home, there's always the question of how stable things will be in the aftermath. And sometimes, as with Kenya, it goes, you know, more or less all right. Sometimes, as in Algeria, there's a revolution. What happened in Vietnam is more like what happened in Algeria. Whether the Taliban will just kill Karzai, President Karzai, and take over Afghanistan after the U.S. leaves, or whether the Afghan army that's been reconstituted can at least protect the capital and the north, it remains to be seen. But it's just, you know, if you colonize, you have to ultimately decolonize, and decolonization is a very unstable process.
Had the United States done anything else, they still would have been an occupier, a Western occupier, and the results probably would have been not much different.
Yeah, the U.S. In Afghanistan, and of course it was not just the U.S., but NATO. People forget the French have fought and died there, and lots of other nations. But the Western presence in Afghanistan was differently received in different parts of the country. In the north, you have Persian-speaking Tajiks, you have Hazara Shiites, you have Uzbeks. It was relatively popular, quite frankly, as far as anybody can tell. And they had hated the Taliban. In the south and the east, you have the Pushtun population.
I realize we've come to the end of the hour. we could go on from here, but I'd love to. But I want to thank you very much for being our guest today, Professor Juan Cole. His blog is Informed Comment, which you can find on the web. Thanks so much for being our guest today and talking about Egypt.
It's been great. Thanks for having me on.
Take care.